I don't want you to get deported. San Francisco would lose a very cool person, quite possibly one of the only cool people. How does it feel to know that you are one of the only cool people here? Literally, how does it feel to be so cool living here? I feel like that's being like the prettiest woman in Idaho. Like you're just like at the top. Like you go to New York and you're normal cool. You come here and it's like, I don't know, rolling out of bed with a leather jacket every morning.
I would say it's an uncomfortable burden to bear. It's sort of like being the only person who can fight fires, you know? You have to fight a lot of fires.
Yeah, that is actually an uncomfortable burden. I bet people ask for your music recommendations all the time.
Constantly. Just when I'm walking down the street, people run up to me and say, please, I need a playlist, save me.
I actually do need a playlist, so like maybe after our show you can give me one. Okay, we are starting now. I'm here with Sasha Chapin. Chapin. No. No. Gwende, someone I'm going to do that with is not going to be a white man. It's going to be really embarrassing for me. I'm here today with Sasha Chapin, who is going to talk with me about the power of meditation. He's the only cool person in San Francisco. So, welcome to my show, Sasha.
Very happy to be here.
So, let's begin the episode with a guided meditation. Can you walk me through a quick calming session? Like, how do we do this? Are you going to stare into my eyes? Do we close our eyes? Like, what happens?
Believe it or not, creepy guru-style eye contact is not required during meditation. I think doing a formal meditation right now would not be a great use of our time. Maybe I could just offer a prompt, which is maybe right now there's some sense of expectation in the room. I feel maybe some slight pressure to sound especially smart or wise or something, to say memorable podcasty things. And maybe you might feel some anxiety or pressure around being a great interviewer or doing a great job. And maybe we could see just for a second if we could drop that sense of expectation and just...
I wasn't moving my hand or anything. Just...
I was distracted by a quirky hand movement. Maybe we could just drop the sense of expectation if there is one. Maybe if we can't drop the expectation, because if we can't drop it, then it's not intentional. It's not something we're doing. We could just see if we can be at peace with that sense of expectation. Just something in the room, just like the sound of the dishwasher or the temperature of the air. It's not a problem that we feel that.
I like that. Although no one has ever called me neurotic in my life. Like I've never... never experienced anxiety, not one time. Okay, I'll try to release all expectations I have towards myself of being clever and successful. So, what is meditation? Let's just outline some basics for my listeners. What is it?
This is a really complicated question because there are a lot of different styles of meditation and there are different goals in meditation. I would say that the thing that unites meditative practice is profoundly unintuitive or counterintuitive mental step, which is instead of attending to the goals of your activities or your intentions, what you want out of something, you're turning your attention to the part of your mind that wants things and plans things. You are attending to conscious experience itself rather than living out the goals of a person with conscious experience.
So then meditation is not just the removal of thoughts, but the removal of goals and desires.
Oh, not at all.
Okay.
So if you could voluntarily remove your thoughts and goals and intentions, you would probably be the greatest meditator literally of all time. I don't know anyone who's done that. And certainly I'm not that way. During meditation practice, I have thoughts and goals. There are reasons why I'm meditating. And I have thoughts about why I'm meditating during meditation. But it's trying to examine the contents of your experience and sort of see life as it is rather than just being captured by the flow of things.
So it's being present.
No two-word reduction of meditation is going to satisfy me, but being present is a pretty good two-word reduction.
Well, you know, I'm good at being short. Okay, so... So how did you get involved in it, in the practice of meditation?
I've been practicing meditation on and off for about 16 years, and I first encountered spiritual practice in a serious way. Spiritual practice is another way of saying meditation work. Spiritual practice is a class of activities that encompasses meditation and prayer and other things like that. I encountered it when I was 20, and I heard about this thing called enlightenment that some Buddhist meditators experienced. And when I heard about the idea, what it sounded like to me was the total disappearance of my personality and my sense of self. And that sounded good because I didn't realize it at the time, but I had a lot of self-loathing. And so I entered into meditation practice with the goal of vanquishing the annoying person that I thought I was.
You're so likable. Like, I cannot imagine you ever thinking you're annoying. That's not me being sarcastic. I really mean it. So meditation, the art of being present, and you got involved because you wanted to hate yourself less.
No, that would be ascribing too much sanity to my younger self. I wanted to, in a certain sense, stop existing. I had this idea that Buddhist monks or meditators, after a certain point, they sort of got to completely throw away their original nature and be in this perfect state of uninvolved neutrality, just floating through life, not being bothered by a personality or emotions. I think that's some people's goal during meditation. Eventually, that goal got replaced with better goals. But I was laboring under a misconception about meditation for a long period of time.
So, okay, if meditation is being present, what is the difference between meditation and mindfulness?
I would say that mindfulness is an aspect of meditation. So I would say that mindfulness is just paying attention to your experience, which a lot of people don't do, right? Like, mindfulness in and of itself is special because the default human inclination is just to get up and be locked in your routines and go through your day in a somewhat automatic state. So mindfulness, you can think of as kind of a first step. I think if you're mindful a lot and you point the camera of attention towards certain facets of experience you take for granted, you start to notice some funny things about your experience. Like, you tend to refer to yourself or think of yourself as if you're this solid, unchanging character moving through time and space. But with more attention, it's revealed that the part of your experience that you would call yourself is fluctuating here and there. It appears and disappears. It's sort of like a piece of music with a lot of variation. And one kind of magical thing about human consciousness too is, and I would sort of call this real meditation, if you're mindful about your experience for a long period of time, certain fundamental facets of your experience start to change. And they change in a way that, in my experience and the experience of a lot of other people, is extremely pleasant. Makes life a lot easier on the whole. Generally, I would say that involves a reduction in a self-centered, sort of me-centric point of view, and the promotion of what you might call the spiritual perspective, a perspective of seeing yourself as an element of this larger unfolding thing we call existence or consciousness or whatever.
So it essentially separates you from the world as we know it so that you can observe it more deeply. Is that right? I feel bad because I'm trying to summarize these very deep philosophical concepts you are telling me into bite-sized meditation for dummy style. Like, do you remember those, like, computer for dummies? My dad had a bunch of those. I feel like I'm trying to do meditation for dummies. That's not possible. Okay. So it puts you into a different flow state than the average person. We can say when you meditate and you're deeply mindful, you are more observant. What is the benefit of that?
So there are a couple of things. I find life much more beautiful from the perspective that I'm lucky to have encountered through long-term meditation. Now imagine you're a leaf on a tree and you're, you know, growing from a tiny, tiny little leaflet. I don't know what a leaf is just before it becomes a leaf, but you're a tiny little leaf on a tree. And the whole time you're a leaf on a tree, you're thinking, God, I want to be the best leaf of all. I want to be the most special. Am I doing this right? What do the other leaves think of me? You're in a maximally self-conscious place, where you're constantly scrutinizing your identity and measuring yourself. And you have a sense that you are somehow apart from the rest of the organism, that you're like fucking up your leaf job, that you're the only leaf who's uniquely defective and unlovable, versus a perspective where you're like, I'm a leaf on a tree. There are all these other leaves. Isn't it cool to be a part of this giant, intelligent superorganism? And then one day I'm going to fall from this tree and there are going to be more leaves just like me. And that won't be a huge tragedy. there are going to be more leaves. I would say my perspective is now a lot more like the latter perspective than the former perspective. I think a lot of people might hear that and think that that shift in perspective towards a more collective and sort of more relaxed perspective necessarily involves becoming a lazy, unambitious jello person. I think that might happen with some people. For me, that hasn't been the case. I'm about as ambitious and hardworking as I was before these mental changes happened to me. Maybe even a little bit more ambitious. I get in my own way less professionally. I'm a lot more relaxed about it. I have a sense of myself as being part of this huge experiment called humanity, rather than like being the only uniquely unlovable or uniquely defective part of it, which is certainly how I felt a lot of the time before. Does that make sense?
It totally does, but I wonder how you prevent that from forming into nihilism. So if I hear I'm not special, just a little leaf on a tree and all the other leaves are like me, I'm never going to be brighter and bigger than the other leaves. It's fine. I like cognitively know that's true. But I feel like if I were to really internalize that, I'd be like, why does it matter? I'm just going to die anyway. No one's even going to remember me because there'll be a new better leaf that will take my place. It's probably already happened.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I could say, well, if you just experienced the alternative, you'd know that it was better, but that would be sort of a cop-out. I think being functional from the default individualistic, let's call it egocentric perspective, and being functional from a perspective that is different than that, takes some adjustment. I mean, so some people try and speed up their meditative progress and go really, really fast and try and undermine the individualistic perspective as intensely as possible. And I think that can backfire because the sense that one is a special and separate self is load-bearing for a lot of people. And as I said, it's been 16 years since I started meditating and started encountering spiritual ideas. And 16 years is a long enough time that I've been able to slowly build up a new system of motivation and new reasons for doing things that aren't quite so ego-based. I think it takes time. You know, you hear about people who go away for intense retreats or do a lot of psychedelics or just have big shifts in mind, and then their old life suddenly seems fake, you know, like they're wearing clothes that are too big for them or they're wearing a mask that doesn't fit them anymore. I think that can be really, really disruptive. And I've benefited a lot from taking it slow. Yeah, like part of the journey has involved confronting a feeling of, oh, so I'm not special. Then what am I then? What's my worth as a human being? And, oh, I can't avoid the fear of death anymore. I should take care of that, you know?
Well, Sasha, if you're not special as a human being, what is your identity about yourself now? Because we grow up and we have all of these books. You know, I think we are both millennials. Both probably, yeah. Of course, obviously. We had all these books growing up. It's like Rainbow Fish. You need to get the, like, bright, shiny shell or whatever. We don't have much time for me to think about this. Okay, so we have all these books that tell us, you know, we're special, we're one of a kind, and that I feel like that is something I see with a lot of millennials. That is just a really deep part of our identity. When you got rid of that, what did your self-identity look like?
Yeah, so let's say the before picture, the identity I was clinging onto was I am valuable because I'm this intelligent writer guy and people are going to admire my work and I'm going to stand out from everybody else. And that was a reliable source of affirmation for a period of time, but it got old. I would say in the uncomfortable middle between that and a post-meditation perspective, it was something like, I'm just another self-conscious smart aleck who wants to prove his worth via assembling the contents of an overstuffed vocabulary. And that's not that special. And my pain isn't that special. And I think the post-meditation perspective is something like, I am part of this very large collective species. And just like every other member of that species, I have a really interesting and particular role to play that in its very specific details has elements that only I understand. There are things to be done on this earth that only I can do in particular. That's also true of everyone else. So it's sort of like before I thought I need to be more special than everybody else. In the middle, I was like, I'm not special and that sucks. And afterwards I was like, oh, we're all a part of this incredibly intricate dance and no one little point in the web of consciousness can see all of it. And it's so cool that I have this tiny little pinhole on this giant perspective shared by all of us. You know what I mean? I guess I transitioned from, I really need to try hard to be special, to, oh, we're all special, myself included, and I don't need to try that hard. I just need to keep playing my part.
The last thing I'll say about this, but do you feel like maybe that's influenced by the fact that you are the only cool person in the city? So you don't really have to try as hard? Okay, don't answer that. Next question. I would feel comfortable about my coolness and specialness if I were living in San Francisco. What is the best environment to meditate in? And also, what postures are best? Like, what clothes are best? What environment should someone get into if they want to be very successful at meditating?
So I think the biggest issue that people have when they're starting out with meditation is they pay a lot of attention to the rules and not a lot of attention to their experience. The right technique in meditation for you at any one time is the technique that helps you let go of some mental habits that are causing you suffering, and the technique that lets you see what's going on more clearly. And even that is a bit sterile and limiting. At times in your meditation practice, you might want to emphasize whatever opens your heart most or whatever gives you the most beautiful, enriching perspective. There's a meditation teacher I like, a lot of people like, Rob Berbea, and he said that any insightful way of looking is a way of looking that brings letting go, right? And that changes a lot from person to person. There's a lot of variation there because people's fixations and neuroses are different. I would say for most people, a posture that balances comfort and alertness is best. So somewhere between sitting totally upright and super rigidly and just lying down in a random position, like a piece of spaghetti dropped on the floor. But some people have really intense, fast, sharp minds, and for them, reclining meditation could be better. Some people have really lazy, floaty minds, and for them, standing meditation could be best, or walking meditation. So it really depends on the individual. I personally lived in the desert for 5 months at one point, and I loved living in the desert for meditation because there are obviously very few noises or distractions. And if you're living in the desert and you're driving for hours and there's not much to do, it's a great canvas for experimentation on your own mind. I think people who experience profound changes in meditation tend to be people who are constantly running experiments, thinking, how do I perceive the world? What's that doing to me? And how could I perceive it differently? There's sort of open-minded approach where you're not taking for granted your basic sense perceptions and your basic habits of perception. For me, the desert was a great place to do that. And if I lived in New York or something, everyday life might be so exciting that it would be hard to rip myself away from experience to look at experience, if that makes sense.
Very interesting, because I feel like people who live in New York or very busy cities need meditation the most. Someone is in that sort of environment. What are some steps you would recommend for them to get into a Zen or a flow state for meditation?
Yeah. So I think my favorite meditation prompt of all time period is from teacher Locke Kelly, "What is here when there is no problem to solve?" And I think that's a really powerful prompt because our sense of time and space and what's relevant in so much of our lives is affected by this slicing we do of reality into what's relevant for the current problem we have to solve and what's not relevant for the current problem we have to solve. I think if you really take on that prompt, what is here when there is no problem to solve, in any particular moment of your life, it can allow you to snap into this really open, spacious, full way of looking at reality. And one way of meditating was perfectly legitimate is to do that frequently, you know, for 30 seconds to 2 minutes throughout your day. And so if I was living in New York, maybe I would think, okay, I'm on the subway, there's a crazy person, I'm off to work, there's all this stuff capturing my attention, but what's here when there's no problem to solve? Drop into that for 2 minutes, then at work, same thing, and just intersperse that throughout my day. That is indeed a way I've practiced during busy parts of my life.
So to relax yourself, you say, what would I feel like if there was no problem to solve right now? If you're on a subway with a crazy person next to you, maybe that is self-loving. There's a crazy person. It's sad. Mental health in this country is really a very big problem. If you were to relax and not pay attention, that might not be ideal in that scenario.
Okay, when I make that recommendation, I'm assuming that you are not under direct physical threat.
What if you zonk out and then you become an easier target? Sasha, do you think about these things? I live in a state where there's concealed carry, so I have to think about these things.
Okay. Why don't I just trust you about when you are likely to experience physical threat, and then say, I'm assuming there are at least half a dozen moments in a day where you're not under physical threat. Maybe that would be the best time to adopt that prompt.
Okay, last question I'll ask about this. Many people live in environments where they are constantly under physical threat. They're in abusive homes. They're in controlled environments like at work or school, which may not be conducive to their inner peace. What would you recommend they do? How can they incorporate meditation when they're on edge all of the time?
I might not advise meditation under those circumstances. I'm not here to say that meditation, especially the kind that I do, is right for everybody or at all times. If somebody is very physically unhealthy, I would say that they're likelier to experience big increases in well-being through exercise and taking care of themselves than they are through meditation. Yeah, if somebody is, you know, yeah, in an abusive relationship where anything they do is likely to be turned against them, or they're constantly being surveilled, then yeah, like whatever they can do to get out of that situation. I've heard very powerful experiences of people who are in prison, getting a lot out of spiritual practice, that being a way to surrender to life and shut down the part of their mind that's constantly asking, you know, why me, and constantly sort of rebelling against the situation. But obviously that's pretty specialized, you know? Yeah, I think one mistake lots of meditators make is to think that it is a panacea and it's the one size fits all solution for every kind of mental suffering in every situation. And I don't happen to think that's true.
Yeah. And if you're in prison, you really have to just think about literally anything but the environment you're in. Yeah, it makes sense. So you say the type of meditation I do. What is the type of meditation you do, and what are the different types of meditation?
I don't know all the styles of meditation, and there are too many to list, and that would be sort of a boring way to answer this question. I would say that I think of the kind of meditation I do as deconstructive meditation. That is meditation with the goal of altering the sense of self and your understanding of self in the world, and de-emphasizing the sort of individualistic perspective. As I mentioned earlier, there are many meditative traditions around the world, both in the Christian world, the Buddhist world, the Hindu world, that have arrived at this motive, because self-consciousness really blows. It's really hard to be self-conscious. A lot of people find the alternative to be more pleasant and beautiful. As for techniques, I have done a lot of different meditation techniques. One of the amazing things about being a meditator in the world today is that so many teachings that previously would have been extremely esoteric, maybe you have to go to India, you have to travel to Tibet, you have to go a long way to hear these meditation masters speak, a lot of it is instantly accessible. I think a lot of meditators benefit from experimenting with different styles of meditation and changing their techniques over time. And that's certainly been my approach. I would say that right now, my meditation is like very light on technique. When I sit down on the cushion every day, I just try not controlling my mind and not having any particular state as a goal. And that's always interesting to me.
Okay, this might be a little embarrassing, but I have always thought of meditation as a practice where you have to clear your mind of all thoughts. And if you have any thoughts in your brain, you have failed at meditation. So I've never been able to successfully meditate because I don't know how to clear my mind of thoughts. Can I have thoughts while meditating?
Yes, you can have thoughts while meditating. This is a misconception that a lot of people seem to arrive at. I had it myself. I don't know why. I will say that it is occasionally the case when you are in intense meditative practice that thoughts become much quieter or they fall away entirely. However, this is something that tends to arise from certain conditions. You can't make it happen by force. And again, I don't think there's a single meditator who can just stop their thoughts instantaneously just by thinking about it. You can sort of mentally clench up and dissociate for short periods of time, but it feels really shitty and it's not really productive. So I'm sorry you labored under that misconception.
Thank you for saying sorry. I did labor under that misconception. I felt very bad about myself. And it's like, no wonder everybody says I need to relax. I can't meditate because I can't clear out my mind. There is a guided meditation by Alan Watts that I really like. The only way I've been able to successfully meditate, you could have metrics of success for meditation, is by listening to him. And he has this 3-minute long talk that I really enjoy. And he talks about minds in the grips of vicious circles. So if you think all the time, you'll have nothing to think about but your own thoughts. I really love that. But he doesn't really tell you how to stop doing that. The only thing he says, he's like, don't try to, or you'll, it's like trying to make rough water smooth with a flat iron. It's like, yeah, I know you can't do that, but what do you do? If your mind is in the grip of vicious circles, what do you do to stop?
Yeah, so there are different things you could do. One thing that helps a lot of people with very fast and verbal minds is mantra practice. I just sit there, breathe in and out, and on every out breath, silently repeat a phrase. It can be any phrase. It can be, I love broccoli. It could be, I am loving awareness. It could be, peace is within me. It could be something religious, something not religious, whatever. And having a repetitive object to put your mind on tends to gradually quiet thoughts, not always, but tends to have that effect. Another practice that some people like is noting, which is continuously using your inner voice to remark about what's going on. So when you're breathing in, rising, 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 commenting on your stomach rising, and then falling, falling, falling as you breathe out. That's a technique. For some people, quieting down thoughts is best accomplished by just releasing the idea that stuff is a problem. Coming back to the prompt I said earlier, what does it feel like when there's no problem to solve? Sometimes your thoughts are racing around because you're trying to dissociate from some emotion or something that's in the room, or just the basic weirdness of being alive. And if you drop the idea that that's a problem or that you need to fix it, for some people that quiets your thoughts a lot.
That's really good. I am going to start doing that. I'll have a mantra. My mantra will not be about broccoli, though. I'm trying to not feel stressed. Okay. So when you talk about that, I've heard meditation can be used to help you not make mistakes, you know, to succeed more in life. How can meditation help us reduce errors from bias, like accidentally acting out emotions from past negative experiences? I don't want to provide an example.
So I think a lot of the most self-destructive behaviors in people's lives comes from acting instinctively in situations where you're emotionally triggered. Something has reminded you of a traumatic experience, or somebody has just hit a nerve, a sore spot. You get that fight or flight mentality. And for me, meditation really helps me notice that. So I would say my baseline condition is an almost irritating level of happiness and stability. Like I'm a really abnormally cheery person most of the time, but not all the time. And I think it's really, really easy for me to notice now when I'm triggered. And there's a teacher I really like, Tucker Peck, and he calls this 1% mindfulness. It's the idea that one of the greatest gifts of meditation is there's a situation where 99% of you is triggered, upset. You're in a zero-sum mentality where everyone's out to get you. You're unsafe. Life is always going to be bad. But there's that 1% of you that's in a more adult place. And that 1% can often restrain the other 99% and stop you from yelling at somebody you love or hastily making a bad financial decision or other things like that, unwise moves that people tend to make when they're really activated. And if you compound that over a lifetime, just a lifetime of increased emotional intelligence and decreased reactivity, I think that's a pretty huge effect. It is for me, at least. Like, I think my marriage is probably the most important part of my life, and meditation certainly makes me a better partner, because any marriage is going to have moments that are triggering and emotionally challenging, but I'm a lot better than I used to be, certainly, at noticing, oh, I'm the problem, and I need to take care of my own feelings right now rather than inflicting them on my partner.
Not going to make an R&B joke. Nope. We don't have time. I have like 10 minutes left. So when you talk about it, making your marriage better and other parts of your life better, how can someone use meditation to help them heal from past negative events? So removing, you know, traumatic memories or bad things that have happened to them. That was a massive leap, but we don't have a lot of time.
Cool. Big subject. But I would say the view from 10,000 feet is that, so one way you can characterize learning from traumatic experiences is your brain detects that you're unsafe. There's something that it's really important that you remember the danger or circumstance that made you feel unsafe. So your mind shoots into fast learning mode and tries to absorb every single detail of the situation, such that anytime you're in a future situation that is reminiscent of the dangerous situation, you become vigilant again. And this causes all sorts of problems for people, obviously, because with enough traumatic experiences, then almost any experience in life can start to look potentially dangerous. You're walking around your life in a state of vigilance, never feeling totally emotionally safe, right? And there are so many methods of trauma learning and rewriting this, but one thing that seems to underlie pretty much all of the methods of reversing trauma is that to reverse a traumatic memory, you need to re-examine it somehow in a state of nervous system safety. And meditation can be great for learning how to cultivate nervous system safety on demand, or if not on demand, at least having more reliable access. So I think one thing that meditation can do is make people into a really, really good therapy patient. Unless you're an exceptionally skilled therapist, it can be really hard to work through trauma with people because every time you talk about it with them, they feel unsafe again, that re-triggers them. If you can use meditation to establish that baseline of safety, it's a lot easier to plumb around in your life and review episodes in your life that have been difficult, that have left marks on you, without bringing up that sense of bitterness and reactivity and that feeling of danger.
So being in a peaceful and meditative state while you think about traumatic experiences is how meditation can really help clear those blockages. Very interesting. So speaking about trauma and meditation, personally speaking, all of my stress comes from other people, like their expectations and feelings towards me. That's where all my stress comes from. How can I use meditation as a blocker so that I never have to feel stress or pain? That's funny. It's a really serious question. I'm expecting you to solve my problems right now.
With this one weird trick, I will solve all your problems.
Yeah, let's do it.
It's funny. I think I feel less stress and pain than I ever have with meditation. Yeah. And I suspect you would too if you entered into a serious meditation practice. But I think don't feel stressed and pain again is not a super workable strategy. I think a more workable strategy is, there's a teacher named Andrew Holacek who defines meditation as habituating to openness. And I really like that. It's this idea that normally we experience stress and pain and we tend to close down or push against it and create this whole other secondary layer of mental suffering that's not totally necessary on top of the normal stress and pain of being a human being. The idea is we can learn to remain open to the stress and pain of life, and that magically both makes the stress and pain easier to take as well as tends to decrease the reactive behavior that leads to more stress and pain. But okay, if all of your stress and pain comes from expectations others place on you, I think one thing meditation can teach you to do is have more optionality around which expectations you take seriously and which you don't.
Very interesting. So meditation really does seem like a great tool for healing trauma, supporting your body. Meditation is so great. Why does it seem like everyone who does it takes MDMA?
I think this is a good question. I think most of the really long-term meditators I know do fewer drugs, I would say, because the longer you're at meditation, the more plastic your mind becomes, the easier it is to get the stuff you want to get from drugs from just mental practice. I think people who get into especially deep meditation tend to be higher in psychological openness and adventurousness. Like the sales pitch, you can do this esoteric practice and completely change the way you view yourself and life as a whole. And I can't tell you exactly what it's going to be like, but it's going to be really cool. That's a pitch that's going to appeal to the kinds of people who are probably also interested in psychedelics, people who are into changing the shape of their mind a lot. I would say also that for people who haven't had a ton of meditative experience, drugs are fast, you know? Like for someone who's just starting out in meditation, if they went on a week or 2 week long meditation retreat, probably at some point in those week or 2 weeks, they would experience something as mentally powerful as a psychedelic drug. That's just the norm if you're doing retreat practice. But that's a week or two, and that requires totally disconnecting from email and your work and everything. Just taking a pill on a Saturday night might be easier to fit into your busy modern lifestyle.
That makes sense. Okay, we only have 5 minutes. All right, so Ashley's got a very limited schedule, but I do have 3 questions I'm going to shove in 5 minutes, which is the antithesis of this whole podcast episode. I've heard it said that if you don't have time to meditate for 5 minutes, then you need to meditate for an hour. Why?
I love that saying. It's such an annoying Zen saying. Zen people specifically love saying pithy things that are annoying. The logic behind that, as far as I can understand, is if you have the feeling that you don't have more than 5 minutes to spare, that's probably not literally true, right? Unless you're like an ER doctor or there's a bunch of like actual fires you need to put out. Probably what's happening is you're catastrophizing. You have lots of stuff in front of you, lots of people asking things of you. You don't feel like you have the time to apply creativity about what you choose to do and what obligations you let go of. That feeling of crowded, cramped, everything is a catastrophe is probably a little bit hallucinatory. And if you sat down and just breathed for half an hour to an hour, you might relax that sense and suddenly discover, oh, I have I have time for the things that need to be done. Not always, but I think it's pretty often that that sense of like, I don't have time, I'll never have time is just a passing fancy of the stressed out brain.
Right. And it's unlikely you are the president or an ER doctor, so you could probably take 5 minutes to meditate or an hour. There's another quote or pithy saying I really love about meditation. By the way, I don't think they're annoying. If you find them annoying, it's just because they're striking true and you are not living up to your potential. The saying I really love is, the mind can go in 1,000 directions, but on this beautiful path, I walk in peace. With each step, the wind blows. With each step, a flower blooms. What flowers has meditation helped you grow? And what flowers do you think meditation is the most effective at helping the average person grow?
I think it really depends on what a person's underlying personality structure is. And it depends on whatever it is they're running from. Like, I think pretty much the default state of the human psyche is to be in flight from something, some core vulnerability or fear or issue we have with life. For me, I used to be really afraid, I think, afraid of pain, afraid of being disliked, afraid of being lonely. And the flower that meditation has helped me cultivate is a kind of openness, a willingness to see that fear and to live with it. And for me, that is very beautiful. I think in some ways, meditation has changed me a lot. In some ways, it hasn't changed me at all. But I think the biggest thing is I used to be full of fear, and I think I'm not now. And that's just a profound change.
So something I think is really interesting about the whole, our bodies in fight or flight mode all the time, the whole idea that, you know, we're no longer in a jungle or a forest, or I guess you were in the desert, but that was by choice. Like, you could have gone back to a city anytime you wanted. You didn't have to stay in the desert. A big part of human survival has been with relationships and attachment to other people. I feel like a lot of personal stress, just from everyone I know, comes from relationships. I mean, one of my friends, her whole house burned down in the LA fire. It was devastating. She lost everything. I've not heard her talk about it past initially telling me about it and raising money. I have heard her talk about the ex-boyfriend she had. I've heard her talk about her ex-boyfriend, and that brought her more suffering than literally losing everything. It's not really an easy question to answer, but we think about fight or flight and how we are not constantly in it. I think we're in it more than ever. Our big threat to ourselves is someone unfriending us on social media or getting dumped or like losing a friend. Those things can cause tremendous upheaval in your body, in your mind, in your heart. What is a meditation strategy you would use for dealing with that, the human condition?
Yeah, that's probably more I can answer in a minute. I will say that in terms of relationship stress, for me, meditation practices on two things simultaneously that have been kind of miraculous in the context of relationships, which has been, I can see more past my own feelings into someone else's feelings, and that allows me to have more compassion for them. But it's also easier for me to not take their feelings personally. I think a lot of people getting into trouble in friendships and relationships is taking on, like, you think in order to empathize with somebody, you need to sort of fuse with them and be angry if they're angry or experience their sadness as a threat. And for me, that's a lot less true than it used to be. So, you know, my wife can be having a bad time or even be angry about something, and I don't experience it as threatening. It's just something you observe, and I'm ready to be there for it and whatever way that's required, hopefully, when I'm at my best. You know, I'm not always that way, but I'm that way more often. It's a constant dance. It's a constant puzzle, how to see other people and how to take their experience seriously while also trying to maintain your own subjectivity and realize that their emotions don't threaten you. So you don't have to manage or fix all of their reactions. For whatever reason, sitting still and doing nothing for like half an hour a day really helps for me.
I love that. Well, we're at 5:16 exactly. Do you have to go now? Yes, he does. He's getting up. Thank you so much for coming on my show, Sasha.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a pleasure.
You have a mantra you want to leave my listeners with?
Meet your friends from the internet. It turns out they are nice.
We did an hour and 5 minutes, so the whole pithy statement is wrong.
standing. That's what we want. Why do we hide it? Empathy hunt. Absence is beauty. Just ask the light. When it goes missing, darkness to confidently stride into the step of the groove. Do you ever wonder if they see you for you when you're out of your shell? I don't ever wanna be a caricature of myself.
Lady in the car next to mine in traffic. We smiled and waved to each other. It's pretty wild to think about how everyone has their own lives going on every day. I like to imagine that she had the same thought, and we'll never ever meet or talk to each other. I don't want to keep acting like these moments in my day only include myself. When I look at you, you try to tell me everything in one glance, but I don't even see you.
I don't mean to be melodramatic, but everyone else is equally neurotic, right? I worry because I always forget when I look at you that you'll also have these same problems, and I also worry that when you look at me, you'll forget that I also have the same problems. But right now, I think I see it for you. I want to. And I want you.